Well, greetings to all of you that are here today and for those online. And I want to send a special greeting, even though they're not online today, to all of our like-believing fellowships, those of us who have come from what we have at times have referred to as our parent organization that has deeper roots than we might think. But there is a phenomenon that we find in our groups that we could call stuck in a proverbial rut. And I think you can think of many applications of that particular title. But at times we do get stuck in a rut. Any of us who have ever done off-roading, or if you're driven down some, you know, dirt roads out in the woods or something, you encounter ruts. And a lot of times when it's wet, you can't get out of those ruts. You can try, and you drop back into them again. And the ruts take you where they're going. Well, we can do that as well in the things that we believe or the things that we use to create what we believe. Some conversations after the recent holy days made me realize that there's some things that we need to clarify because of long-standing beliefs that we have had kind of distract us from understanding God's magnificent plan for humanity. He intends to provide the opportunity for salvation to everyone who has ever lived. And that is an amazing thing when we consider how many people have already lived and died who were never called. The Father never called them, as John 6:44 tells us. We could say they really never had a chance, or those that die in adolescence or infancy never had a chance. God has a plan for them. And we need to understand that plan. Sometimes we get in ruts in life, and we certainly do in our belief system at times. I've encountered many of these in my past Protestant experience, where certain ideas, certain teachings dominate how people come to understand the Word as they read it. It's often been said that a little bit of error can go a long way in leading believers into wrong ideas or wrong conceptions or wrong conclusions, just a little error. Take, for example, the idea of an immortal soul. Where do you go with that? It has ramifications in a whole area of thought. Religion is plagued with many, many misconceptions that distract people from the important truths. Think of how many unbiblical beliefs there are that form the basis for the varying, differing denominations. They're not hidden. Oftentimes, they're not at all subtle. But as believers, we can get stuck in a rut ourselves. And it's hard to get out of that groove when we're in it. I think most of us are familiar with the Millerite movement of 1844. And believe it or not, our genre has some connection with those roots that long ago. There's a major denomination today that still perpetuates some of the ideas that formed in the middle 1840s. There's a major denomination that teaches that the earth is going to be uninhabited during the millennium for 1,000 years. No life on earth. This is a major denomination that we know of that teach that. And you have to wonder, in the light of the scriptures that are very clear on the subject, why? Well, there is that rut. Their scholars could find their way out of that just as easily as not, but there's reasons, for some reason, that they don't want to do that. I should preface this by saying that there's no religious belief system that is exempt from getting it wrong here and there. A lot of times it's the result of leftover ideas from previous beliefs. Then again, we've got the situation that we find, we read of in Daniel chapter 12, verse 9. Some truths are purposely concealed for a time, and it's not always people's fault. God reveals things in His way and in His time. Oftentimes, credibility of the preeminent leadership can be an obstacle to getting out of the ruts. There's people that are reluctant to embrace any rethinking. And it should be obvious, thinking of the broader religious scene, there's a lot of hogwash in religion. You may have noticed that. It was back in 2005 when the material in this booklet that I wrote, this is my first booklet, was presented to the United Church of God Doctrinal Committee. It wasn't compiled as a booklet then, it was just a collection of study papers, but it was submitted to the Doctrinal Committee, and they reviewed it. Now, I should say that it was written, the articles were written based on our longstanding teachings. And the Doctrinal Committee, and it came back to me in a letter from Leon Walker, who was the chairman of that committee at the time. This was back in 2005, maybe early 2006, where he took exception to some of what was in here, realizing that there was a problem. And I agreed with him. But I'm just saying, what I presented to them first was our long-standing teaching that I have been aware of since the early 60s. He took exception to the idea that people who are raised in the second resurrection would die again and then have to be re-raised another time to stand in judgment at the end. Can you see the problem there? Well, there was a problem, but that was our belief at the time, based on Isaiah 65:20. We thought that people who were raised in the second resurrection would die at the end of their restored lifetime. So far as I know, that's still in the background of some people's thinking. But it was something that needed correction. It was back in about 1978. A traveling evangelist came through town, and most of us know who that is, Evangelist Gerald. And he gave us this presentation, which kind of described the whole plan of God as we understand it. But even those of us in the congregation at the time realized there was a problem. The problem was those people who are converted during the millennium, or those people who are converted during the second resurrection era, how and when do they become spirit-born members of the family of God? We didn't have a good answer. And we could see the problem, because the idea was that those people who were converted would never die, but they would be brought into the family of God, as will those people who are alive and remain at the time of Christ's coming. We surrounded, there was a number of us, probably 8 or 10 of us, surrounded Evangelist Gerald afterwards, and we asked him that question. Those people who are converted during the millennium, when are they brought into the spirit-born family of God? And based on the thinking at the time, his answer was rather simple and direct, and he didn't explain it any further, but he just said, as they qualify. Some of you may have heard something like that. In other words, those people who become converted, when they reach a certain level of conversion, they're made spirit beings on an ongoing basis throughout those 1,100 years or whatever. See the problem. So that was our issue. Now, another part of that problem was the proclamation that the third resurrection involved the wicked only, which kind of sets up that question that I just asked before. What happens to those who aren't wicked? The thinking is that the wicked only come up for sentencing at the end. But what about the rest? Now, there's an obvious situation that any of us should have raised in the question ourselves. We have that incident in, I believe it's Matthew 25, where Jesus very clearly talks about the sheep from the goats. The sheep from the goats. There is a situation where the sheep and the goats are going to be raised together and are going to be segregated out from among one another, with the sheep put on the right hand and the goats on the left. When is that? If we're going to go with the teachings that we were so familiar with back in the 50s and 60s and 70s, if we're going to go with that, how do we answer the question, when does this sheep from the goats situation occur? At what point in time, in which resurrection, do righteous and unrighteous come up together? That's the question we need to answer. I might mention at this point that there are two major passages of Scripture that talk about all three resurrections together in the same place in sequence. And they're found in John chapter 5 and Revelation 20. Now you can take those two narratives and harmonize them together because one enhances the understanding of the other. For those of you who have this booklet, it's on the inside, just before chapter 1, there's a harmonization of these two narratives that show that there are three, and it shows the purpose for each of those three. And it's important that we understand them because they lay out for us how God is going to make salvation available to all who may desire it. But I presented this paper to the UCG Doctrinal Committee, and like I said, Leon Walker responded with a letter, which I still have, taking exception to what I wrote, but what I wrote was based on what they teach, and I don't know that anyone ever bothered to look at it that carefully and see that there's a problem. So I rewrote it, and that's where this booklet came from. It was 18 chapters at the time. But after some review with Richard Pennelly and some others, I weeded out three chapters. It's now only 15. But it covers the subject very thoroughly from about every angle we can. But I resubmitted it for them to review it. And wouldn't you know, that's when the Kagwa situation came along and the doctrinal committee didn't continue. They had other matters to address, so it didn't get re-reviewed. Now, I know that a longtime minister, whose name you would recognize, submitted the same question to them a couple of years later. And from time to time, I ask him, has he heard anything back? And he says, it's crickets. For some reason, they don't want to address those questions. So things are left as they are. The major point is, and we can count on this, the Scripture says very plainly that it is appointed unto men once to die. Not multiple times, not multiple resurrections, which our explanation kind of called for. People don't die the first death multiple times. Now, that would tell us something. That would tell us that those people who come up in the second resurrection don't die again and then have to be resurrected again to stand for the final sentencing. That's important to understand. I think that should be an obvious problem that we have to work out. Let me go through this and explain how it really works. I think we understand the first resurrection. When Christ returns, those whose names are written in the book of life will be changed from flesh to spirit or raised from the grave as spirit beings to be brought into the greater God family. We understand that. Fine. Nothing more of that sort occurs until after the 1,000 years are finished. We know that from Revelation 20, verse 5. The rest of the dead live not again till after the 1,000 years were finished. That's fine. Easy to understand. So there's going to be another major resurrection after the 1,000 years. Those people are going to come up and stand before their Creator. And it's a very graphic scene that's given to us in Revelation chapter 20. It's in verse 11. Here's the scene. Satan has done his thing. He's been expelled from society from that point, from that day forward. That's in the previous verses. But in verse 11, it says, "And I saw a great white throne, and him that sat on it, from whose face the earth and the heaven fled away, and there was found no place for them." This is that scene where those who are to be raised after the 1,000 years, this is the scene that they are introduced into. "And I saw the dead, small and great, stand before God, and the books were opened, and another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged out of those things which are written in the books, according to their works." Their past works? No. They weren't converted. We're talking about their works from that point on. They're going to have the books opened to them, it says. They're going to begin to understand things that were not possible for them to understand prior to this time of being raised from the dead. So verses 11 and 12 apply to this particular era of time. The Great White Throne Judgment. When you hear that term, what do you think? Do you think of sentencing? Or do you think of opportunity? Because judgment involves both. Hearing of the evidence, and then after the evidence is heard, then the sentencing is possible. A just judgment requires evidence. Here, these people are going to be raised and given the opportunity that they never had. Some, I'm sure the vast majority, are going to opt to avail themselves of what God is offering them at that time. But the Great White Throne begins the Second Resurrection era. It doesn't conclude it. The conclusion of it is in Revelation 14, verses 14 through 20. That is the white cloud judgment. And as you can see from those passages, two groups of people are in that particular resurrection. those that are harvested by Christ for his family and those that he leaves behind for two angels to take care of. Revelation 14 is a like description of the sheep from the goats situation, where righteous and wicked come up together. So the great white throne begins the second resurrection era. But the white cloud harvest concludes it. The white cloud harvest occurs at that point in time where the angel says, the earth is fully ripe. You can't expect any more. Full ripening is ready. God can then determine from those multiple billions who come up who is righteous and who is not. And he can harvest those that he deems righteous into his righteous family, where the rest are left, referring to them as the grapes of wrath. Now, we have people who were converted during the millennial age. We know from Isaiah 65 that they live and die as people do now. We should go to that and look at it in a minute. So people have lived and died during the millennium, as happens now. Some converted and some not. And there too, I think, in the millennial age, the greater majority will avail themselves of conversion and God's Spirit. But they live and die. Now they're in their graves. Righteous people are in their graves all through this period of time. They don't rise in the second resurrection. They're left in their graves. So these people as well, those converted during the millennium and those converted during the second resurrection era, stand in judgment at the end. Those who come up in the third resurrection are not the wicked only, because that creates the problem. What about the righteous? They come up together. The righteous and the unrighteous come up together. And they stand for sentencing. No one is going to be judged, sentenced by God while dead. Everyone will be alive. And graphically alive, if you read Revelation 14, verse 20, there are people that are going to pay for their sinful condition in a very graphic and bloody way. They will pay the penalty for sin by shedding their own blood when we understand that. Now, we should look at Isaiah 65, because this is another part of the problem, or another part of the things that need answers. Isaiah, just to know where it was, 65. Because this verse is also factored into our explanation. And it's particularly verse 20, where it says, and there shall be no more there an infant of days, nor an old man that has not filled his days, for the child shall die 100 years old. But the sinner, being 100 years old, shall be accursed. Now, from that verse, we determined that the second resurrection era was to be 100 years long. It could be. Personally, I believe it's at least a full adult generation, however long that may be. But Isaiah 65:20 is not talking about the second resurrection era. It's talking about the millennium. Read on. And that's what we need to understand. Now, 100 years is the optimum lifespan, even today. I mean, Virgil almost made it. Dell almost made it, just a few years short. You know, 100 years old is about as old as anyone gets. There's a few that get up into the hundred and teens, but it's rare. But that's the optimum lifespan. And that's what Isaiah 65 is talking about. That it's the optimum lifespan, at least in that period of time. But let's read on, because it tells us more. Verse 21, and they shall build houses and inhabit them, and they shall plant vineyards and eat the fruit of them. They shall not build and another inhabit. So we can see that this is a millennial setting. This is not anything like today. They shall not plant and another eat. For as the days of a tree are the days of my people. That's what it's talking about. The longevity, how long will people live? And mine elect shall long enjoy the work of their hands. And they shall not labor in vain, nor bring forth trouble, for they are the seed of the blessed of the Lord, and their offspring with them. Now, let's look at that verse. I want to read it from the New King James. The New King James words it this way. They shall not labor in vain nor bring forth children for trouble, for they shall be the descendants of the blessed of the Lord and their offspring with them. Something we should know, that those people who live during the second resurrection era, the post-millennial era, they will not be bringing forth children. At some point in time, procreation is going to fade off towards the end of the millennium. You can't have babies born on the last day of the millennium and expect that they're going to have an opportunity for conversion. Now, in the second resurrection, both infants and adolescents, young people, teens, all ages, clear up into their 90s, are going to be raised together. Who takes care of the little babies? I mean, their parents are long gone. Well, those who were parents will foster them. They'll love it, wouldn't they? So even the youngsters, even the infants are covered in the second resurrection era, and they're going to be given at least a full adult lifetime, however long or short that may be. But to go to Isaiah 65 and say this tells us that the second resurrection era will be 100 years, it may be. God may give those people the same interval as he does during the millennium. I'm not saying he wouldn't. I'm just saying to use this verse to draw the conclusion that we did, we don't really have good support for that. However you want to look at it, those people who live during the millennial age, in the post-millennial age, will remain alive and will be still alive at the time of the final sentencing, which we read of in Revelation 14, the last six verses or so. Those who were in their graves, as it says in John 5, all who are in their graves will hear and will come forth. So those who are to be in the third resurrection will rise together and stand with those who came up in the second and will be sentenced at that point in time. That is the sheep from the goat situation. That is the white cloud harvest situation. So we need to understand that. And from what I understand, I think all of our genre, all who believe as we do, all who have had the background that we have had, need to look at the matter and clarify it in our minds and get our teaching straight. The bottom line is, all who have ever lived, who are not in the first resurrection, all who have ever lived, will stand together alive for final sentencing. And that exhibits a wonderful plan when you think about it. It's wonderful. No one will be left who has been never given the opportunity to become converted and to be brought into God's family. So this is the area we need to redefine in our thinking and understanding. Let's get our thinking out of the old ruts to where we can understand, where we can conceive of the plan of God more accurately.